Topol, the smoker's tooth polish.
Like the dude from Fiddler on the Roof?
Yes. Were you aware there was a toothpaste named after
Topol?
Topol.
No.
It wasn't named after it, but it existed. Topol, the smoker's tooth polish.
The smoker's tooth polish. Oh.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, but mostly bad. I'm your host, Nick Melton, and my co-host,
Jeff Heatherly, the smoker's toothbrush.
Indeed. Tonight is the final episode of our month of more, or more accurately, month and a half of more.
Yeah, well, this episode is about 4 weeks in the making.
Yeah. 1 week late, because it was supposed to post last week. Oops.
But now it's like 2 weeks late.
Is it?
I don't know. Let's talk.
Anyway, the first installment was V for Vendetta, the second installment was The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and we decided not to do From Hell, which leaves this last film from 2009, directed by Zack Snyder. Watchmen!
Wow.
Based, of course, on the graphic novel by Alan Moore. And the
novel Push by Sapphire. No.
I don't remember who drew the art. I believe it was Dave McKeon.
Dave Gibbons.
Dave McKeon was someone else. Okay.
Okay.
Anyway, Watchmen.
We're off to a roaring start.
We really are. I got one name wrong out of two.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Watchmen. What's there to say to kick off this discussion about Watchmen?
It's going
to
be an interesting one, folks.
How about Jeff? Your thoughts on Watchmen?
As I told you while we were watching the movie, I think this movie is damn near perfect. I really do. There's not a single moment in this movie where I'm cringing about something that is not the movie's fault. Or that is the movie's fault. You know what I mean?
Right.
Anything I'm cringing about is, you know... Well, we'll talk about it.
Okay. My thoughts on Watchmen. Alan Moore is notoriously
critical. He's an asshole savant.
He is, but he's notoriously critical of adaptations of his work. I don't think he's seen Watchmen. He's publicly stated he will never see it. And I guess if you want to be ultra-possessive about your own output, like work, he has a point. I mean, V for Vendetta was a terrible adaptation, though it is a great movie.
Yeah.
The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen... It's also a terrible adaptation and just a meh movie.
Yeah.
And From Hell, I haven't seen in years, so I can't remember if it was a particularly good movie. I don't remember it being terrible, but it was also a terrible adaptation.
I'm just trying to fathom how seriously I could take Heather Graham trying to do a British accent.
Yeah.
How did that go? Do you remember?
No. I remember that Ian Holm was in it, which is awesome.
That's true.
And it was, I forget who the directors were.
But was it the
Hughes brothers?
The Hughes brothers,
I want to say.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Watchmen, we have Zack Snyder, kind of an interesting choice for this movie. I mean,
at that point, all he was known for was Dawn of the Dead and 300.
Both were remake. Well, not they weren't remakes. Adaptations of existing material.
Right.
He hasn't done yet an original movie, although he's got one coming out called...
Sucker Punch.
Sucker Punch, yeah, that I'm actually kind of looking forward to.
I waver. The only thing that's really drawn me to that movie right now is Jon Hamm.
I actually didn't know Jon Hamm was in it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the trailers. I'm just kind of intrigued by the storyline.
Yeah.
But anyway, Watchmen had been in development hell for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
If you look at the history of the development of Watchmen... in the 80s, a guy named Sam Hamm, which is a great name,
yes,
wrote a script for it, which was terrible.
Sam Hamm, the fellow who wrote the, or co-wrote the original Tim Burton Batman, and I think also Batman Returns.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know he did Batman Returns. I know he did Batman. But he wrote a script, and it was terrible. I got my hands on a copy of it, and I could only read, like, the first scene. The first scene, some terrorists are holed up in the Statue of Liberty... threatening to wreak havoc, and the Watchmen come in, because they're the Watchmen now, come in, and there's that great line that when they're coming in, shit fire! It's the goddamn Watchmen!
I can't I'm not like that guy who requires everything to be by the book, but I can't fathom how they got from this to that.
Yeah, I mean, they turned Watchmen into a cartoon, which is exactly what it isn't.
Exactly.
When Watchmen was written in the 80s, superhero comics hadn't reached the level of postmodernist grittiness that they're known for. Like, this was the first comic series that people saw the good guys acting like crazy people.
Right.
Like, Rorschach, one of the main characters, will break a guy's fingers to get information. Nobody had seen brutality like that before from heroes.
Right.
You know, this was, I think, before... Actually, I think it was the same year that Frank Miller wrote The Dark Knight Returns, right, which revolutionized Batman. So basically, those two comic books sort of changed the entire landscape of how one could write for comics. So it was an important book just from that perspective, but it was also a very serious character study of what superheroes could be. Alan Moore wanted to write as if superheroes actually existed in the real world. A character like Batman, who dresses up at night and goes on vigilante, goes on a vigilante spree of justice, would have to be a little bit crazy.
A little bit.
A little bit. So that's where he came up with Rorschach, the character who dresses up in a costume and goes out and beats people up. And throughout the entire comic book, he's presenting these deep psychological traumas or neuroses that explain why these people are wearing costumes. There's the character of Night Owl, who's sexually impotent and can only get it up, basically, when he's out in his costume. There's someone who's doing it because she's got severe daddy issues, and her mom forced her to do it, and, you know, like, a lot of underlying motives. So, yeah, I don't understand how they could have tried and made it so cartoonish. Plus, Sam Hamm's original script had, like, time travel in it, which was...
I really cannot see how they got that. Because
I know.
I'm taking this movie as a, you know, as many people have said, a pretty damn to the letter adaptation.
It is a pretty damn to the letter adaptation, except for the ending, which we will talk about later.
Yes. Let me go ahead and say this now so people can go and get their bitching out of the way. I haven't read the book. Not all the way through. And what I say to you in the course of this this discussion, I'm not saying this, I'm not going to debate whether one thing is better than the other, because that's not what I'm doing. I'm judging this solely as a film.
Right.
And as a film, I love it. I kind of don't give a fuck what you think about the comic. I think the movie is fantastic.
I agree. I think the movie, especially the director's cut, which we watched this evening, is a little long. It's a chore to sit through sometimes, but I think... You know, it's just one of those movies that I was so sad when it did so badly at the box office.
It didn't do so badly.
It did not as good as I'd hoped
it would.
I think people went into the movie not knowing what to expect.
It made a profit of $55 million.
Still, that's not great when the budget was $130 million.
It's true.
People, I think, went in expecting another $300 million, which is what director Zack Snyder was most known for when this movie was made.
Right.
And what they got was this really serious... pretty complex look at neurotic superheroes.
I don't think that was the problem that people faced as an audience. I think that was...
The subject matter, you think, wasn't the problem?
I think it was... I don't think people were looking for 300. I think they were looking for just superheroes. And got superheroes who rape. And break arms with glee. And, you know, just do a lot of crazy shit. They wanted Superman and Batman, and they got... meat cleaver to the head.
Right. So I actually have, you mentioned before we started recording that we weren't going to get philosophical, and I agreed to pretty much keep it out of that, but I have...
I'm just saying that for the sake of your listeners, because I've listened and experienced your V for Vendetta episode and realized that, one, it was late, so I was kind of woozy, and two, I spent the majority of the episode saying things like, man, that's not how my brain works. I don't want to do that to you again.
Right.
Because, I mean, listen, I don't think that, you know, speaks ill of my intellect. It's just that, you know, when I watch a movie, I don't know, it's just not how my brain works.
Like to analyze it while you're watching it. Well, the thing that I was going to ask you, this was the only question that I had, and I know you hadn't read the novel, but in the novel, he makes such a big point, as I said, about making them human, that some of Zack Snyder's choices in this movie are kind of perplexing, and I want to know what you think about them.
Are you referring to the fact to, like, you know, people slamming heads through porcelain and living?
Yeah, I am. Because in the comic, they're clearly human. They're not superheroes. That's the whole point of the book. There are people who happen to dress up in costumes. But in this movie, they still have, like, super strength, super agility. They're super awesome martial artists who can, like, punch bones through people's skin, who can, like, throw knives around with ultra, you know, accuracy, and that's just not how the book was, and I wanted to know how you feel about that.
Well, I think you kind of just answered your own question. See, once again, we're going to this point where I'm saying, I watched this as a film, and this film establishes these concepts you're tossing out at me right now as that's the way the film will do it. You know, right. And with that knowledge, and solely that knowledge, what the book has to say about it doesn't matter to me.
All right, so you don't care if other people might consider that a betrayal of a core concept of the book.
My main problem, and I mentioned this during the V for Vendetta episode, is, and it goes across the board, not just for this movie, but for a lot of book-to-movie adaptations, is just this. I don't like that we've reached this standard as a geek culture, if you will, where if you are a person who hasn't read the source material, you can watch this movie and you can think it is damn near perfect as a film, and I do. And then you'll have people who will, you know, they want to deduct 100 IQ points from you because you just liked the movie. When the movie is as good as this is, and when most people will say that it's a pretty damn flat-out straight adaptation of the book, with the exception of the ending, which once again we'll get to later, this is not the kind of movie you can make that argument about.
Yeah, it's about as literal an adaptation as you could get for Watchmen.
Which a lot of people said was a...
And especially given what scripts we'd been given before.
Yeah.
We should be damn grateful that this version of the movie exists. We watched the director's cut, not the theatrical cut, and you were talking during the movie that you felt that it was kind of disjointed.
Yeah, I guess I'm just so used to the theatrical cut that there's certain things about the director's cut that seem clunky and kind of misplaced.
Like, what do you mean?
Like, there's a flow to the theatrical cut that just works. I mean,
I felt like there wasn't. I thought the theatrical cut was clunky, and like parts of it were a bit disjointed, whereas the director's cut felt more smooth to me.
I don't like it.
I think what you're thinking of is the added scenes.
Probably.
Because what I think the director's cut, while it is about 20 minutes longer, the majority of that is not added scenes. It's more like fleshing out the scenes that are already there. Like adding in a line of dialogue here or a line of dialogue there that more fully explains what they're talking about, or a transition that makes a bit more sense. Although there is one scene that he includes that I don't like at all.
Yeah.
And it's a scene at the beginning of the movie where Rorschach is investigating an apartment, and he comes across these police officers, and he beats one of them up and then stands on the windowsill for like 30 seconds while the other police officer unloads a gun at him at like point blank range and somehow misses. And then they look in the window and, oh, he's gone. I don't get that scene. Nobody that I've talked to who likes this movie gets that scene. I don't know why it was in there. Like, the only theory that we can come up with is that, oh, they're trying to make it look like he's Batman. Like, a mysterious shadow in the night, you know?
Right.
But I just don't get it.
But that's the director's cut. Well, there you have it. That's what I'm saying. I'm so used to the theatrical cut. Like, see,
the transition in the theatrical cut makes a lot more sense.
It does.
In that instance.
There's also, if we want to talk about specific, we haven't even talked about cast yet.
Yeah, I think we should probably do that before we get too into it, because we're saying all these names like Rorschach and Night Owl and people who aren't too familiar with Watchmen, although I'm probably guessing that a lot of the people who listen to this show, people that I know who listen to this show, know what Watchmen is and are familiar with it.
Right.
But just in case, let's talk about it.
I think they have this listed
in...
Not in alphabetical order.
In random order. I'm going to go with random order.
You want to just rock with it?
Yeah, might as well.
Okay. Top bill, we have Malin Ackerman as Laurie Jaspezic.
I don't know how to pronounce it. Nobody I know knows how to pronounce it. So we'll just call her Silk Spectre 2.
Most people say her last name is Jupiter.
Yeah, that's sort of like a alias, but they just sort of kept it for the movie.
Right,
and
right.
The thing is, I've read Watchmen, the book, 4 or 5 times, but it's been just long enough that I can't remember why they used the name Jupiter in the book.
Right.
But the name they give on the Wikipedia page is technically her real name.
Right.
Malin Ackerman, she's all right.
She's serviceable.
She's serviceable, but I think the role demanded a better actress. Because when you think about the role,
I never let it bother me.
It doesn't ruin the movie for me. No, certainly not. But I mean, she's, like you said, she's serviceable.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's such an arc to her character that another actress might have been able to pull it off better.
Right.
But we can talk about it later. Next, we have Jackie Earle Haley as Rorschach / Walter Kovacs.
Jackie Earle Haley, who was absolutely robbed at that year's Oscars.
Seriously.
The fact
amazing.
That he wasn't nominated is just a crime.
And you know why? Because it's a superhero movie.
But I'm
the
just
Academy
saying now.
Like to take
but now
seriously.
We live in this world where we have 10 Best Picture nominees. that we already know for this year are almost guaranteed to include shit like Toy Story 3, which, I mean, God bless Pixar, but still, seriously?
Pixar will win Oscars until the end of time.
But they won't win Best Picture.
No.
But that's not a discussion for today. The point is, Jackie Earle Haley was robbed.
But this was before they had 10 Best Picture nominees.
Well, I mean, that's not even... I mean, it's not even that the 10 Best Picture or nominees would have changed. No, this was...
Because this came out in 2009.
Yeah, this would have been the year it would have happened, yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was robbed. Thanks, Oscars.
Yeah.
I don't like you
They're
anymore.
All about coulda, not shoulda.
We're Oscars. Anyway, Jackie Earle Haley is amazing.
He is.
The only thing that I'd seen him in... Actually, I can't remember when I saw Little Children. It might have been after this movie.
A lot of people talk about that movie.
But he's amazing in Little Children, and he's also the new Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I have no interest in seeing the new Nightmare on Elm Street, but it is one of those movies that I know the entire plot of because my interest was good enough that I just decided to read the Wikipedia page.
Doesn't sound stupid.
Doesn't sound stupid. It sounds like there are certain results that piss me off.
Right.
Certain things that happen to characters in that movie that go beyond scary and into just... That's just cruel to a filmgoer.
Right.
So I don't want any part of it.
That kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks, movies.
Yeah.
All about coulda, not shoulda.
Yeah.
All right. Following coulda, not shoulda, we've got Patrick Wilson as Daniel Dryburgh, a.k.a. Night Owl 2.
Yes.
Why is he Night Owl 2? Because there was a Night Owl before him.
Well, of course, I don't know if we mentioned that Silk Spectre, Marlon Ackerman, was...
Silk Spectre 2.
Yes.
Because her mother was Silk Spectre 1. So they sort of passed the mantle, so to speak. Patrick Wilson, you were talking early in the movie how great it was that they were able to make him look frumpy. Because Patrick Wilson, in real life, is kind of like a total hunk. And
yeah.
It's sort of great that they made him look like...
He's like if Josh Lucas weren't awful. That's basically Patrick Wilson. A little beefier, too. But
Josh Lucas?
He's the poor man's Matthew McConaughey.
Ew.
He was the snooty boyfriend for Jennifer Connelly in First Hulk.
Which I haven't seen.
Oh,
Angle
really?
Lee's Hulk?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Wow. What else could I name? Have you ever seen... God help me, have you ever seen Sweet Home Alabama?
No.
You're lucky.
I know.
He was in that shit too.
Yeah.
Well, that's the point. But you know, Patrick Wilson. You know, the first time you see him, the best way I described it to you was he looks like Chevy Chase circa Vacation.
Yeah.
Like he's got that weird, like patted down hair and like the weird comb over and
those big glasses.
Yeah.
Although Chevy Chase, I don't think wore those in Vacation.
He wore some sunglasses at some point.
Yeah. Well, Patrick Wilson was also in Little Children.
Yes,
with Jackie Earle Haley, so they got to, I guess, have sort of a, I don't want to say chemistry, but they at least sort of were familiar with how to work with each other as actors.
Right.
And since the two characters play former partners, I think that sort of is cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And Wilson actually gained somewhere in the vicinity of like 30 pounds. 25 pounds to play Night Owl, because the way that he's presented is like he's not exactly flabby, but he's
been retired for a while.
He's been retired for a while, so he's not quite in the shape he used to be, although he's still a powerhouse of a man. So there's that. Next we have Billy Crudup. Crudup?
I
don't know.
I think it goes both ways, Ted.
Like a bisexual.
Thank you, Ted. That was the joke.
It would have been criminal if I'd not said it.
Yeah.
he plays Dr. John Osterman, a.k.a. Dr. Manhattan.
We're going to have some things to say about Dr.
Manhattan. Dr. Manhattan, it was kind of interesting watching the movie this time because I hadn't really focused on Dr. Manhattan. Dr. Manhattan almost felt like an emotional core to me.
Yeah.
This time around, which is really odd because he's supposed to be the exact opposite of that.
He's practically a Dan Vulcan.
Yeah. But this time around, I was watching it and the special effects for Dr. Manhattan are amazing.
Yes, they are.
The way that they got his skin to look, the way they got his eyes to look, he looked like a real human being even though it was in... Because you can tell he was entirely computerized.
Right.
It's not like they just took a guy and, like, gave him weird eyes.
Yeah, I mean, Billy Crudup was wearing, like, one of those spandex
suits.
With the spots, yeah. And, like, his face was there, and they just did what they did with that.
They just did with his... Yeah. But given that he's an entirely computerized character, he looks amazing.
Yeah.
So props to the CGI department.
Absolutely.
He's basically the... He plays a character who had a... He's the only superhero, technically.
Yeah.
At least in the book. We've already talked about the super strength thing. But in the book, he's the only character who can actually be referred to as a superhero because he had that classic lab experiment gone wrong that gave him freaky powers.
Yeah.
So that's who that is. Next on the list, we have Matthew Good as Adrian Veidt / Ozymandias. What's there to say about that?
It's weird because we're sitting here listing all these people, and the thing is, it's really hard to describe a lot of these characters. But in addition, I feel that even as a person who hasn't read the books, it's almost better to have read the books to give the best, like, you know, and here's this character and here's what he does.
Right.
You know, I can't do that.
Ozymandias is one of the few former superheroes to reveal his identity to the public. The only other one, I think, is Night Owl 1. A note of contention I have, I hate it when people call this movie The Watchmen.
Yeah.
It just sounds stupid. But also, this movie refers to Watchmen as if it was like the name of the group of superheroes.
It does.
In the book, there's the Minutemen, which are the old generation of superheroes.
Right.
The new one with all these characters that we're naming. They don't really have a name. They're just sort of a group of people. And then the movie just calls them Watchmen just so that they have like a convenient name that the listener can hear and be like, oh, those guys.
Yeah.
The book is called Watchmen because it's obsessed with the notion of power. Like, if you look all through the book, and even in the movie, there's a recurring graffiti, like, on the wall that says, who watches the Watchmen? And the whole point of it is, apart from, you know, human superheroes, who watches the people who are in power?
Yeah.
Like, superheroes have power, so they can take care of crime and stuff, but who's watching them? What if they're criminals?
Right.
Who's going to take care of them? Who's watching the people in power? You know, like President Nixon, who is still president
because
in 1985.
There's an alternate 1985 where President Nixon has during his terms, had the term limits.
Yeah, the Constitution amended so that he can serve for more than two terms.
Yeah.
He's basically like a monarch now.
Yeah.
The monarch of America, so no one's watching him either. So it's kind of the control and power issues that this raises is actually kind of disturbing, but like you said, we'll not get too philosophical or political here.
I mean, you can go into it, but don't expect me
don't
to
expect
have like anything too truly educational to say.
Right. But yeah.
Yeah.
There's that. I do want to talk about his accent for a little bit.
Okay.
In the movie, he has two accents, and I don't like it. He's got this he's got the American accent that he does when he's in public, and then when he's in private, he has a German accent to imply, like, a dual nature, or, like, private and public personas.
Right.
But I don't really, it's kind of confusing if you don't have it explained to you, and also, if he's lived in America his whole life, he wouldn't have a German accent. It's just logically a bad decision.
Well, in his defense, I give you Jackie Chan and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. But I mean, Jackie Chan isn't ever going to pass for American. I mean,
I know, but his accent actually seems to be getting worse, as does Schwarzenegger's. And they've both been here for almost
and
like
yeah, but Schwarzenegger's
35 years.
Like, but Schwarzenegger, I mean, they both grew up in the places where they are from. That sounds really stupid, I know, but you know what I mean.
I know, but still, you'd think there would have been
and
some
Arnold
adjustment
is like,
and actually getting
Arnold,
worse.
Like, his accent is like iconic, though.
But it's getting thicker. And he was the fucking governor of California.
Isn't he still?
No, he...
Oh.
Not anymore.
Oh. Well, clearly I'm up and up on the political...
You certainly
times.
Are.
Well, now I'm embarrassed. Next on the list, we have Jeffrey Dean Morgan playing Edward Morgan Blake, the comedian.
Yes.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who I know best as the dad on Supernatural.
This was a... Okay.
And also as Denny on Grey's Anatomy, which I don't watch. Nor will I ever watch.
I don't know if this was my first experience with him. I knew he was around because I knew there was some guy who I thought was, as I described him in the movie, a combination of Robert Downey Jr. and Gerard Butler, except without Gerard Butler's lesser qualities.
Right.
And so I knew he was out there. I forget what the first thing I would have seen him in would have been. But I did, this may have been the first, but I did just watch the entire first season of Supernatural. As it was airing on TNT, and then, as I told you, my DVR fucked up, and I missed the first two episodes of season two, so I have to wait till it comes back around in the rotation. That's gonna suck. So, unless Netflix really has it, as you said.
I think Netflix
this
does
is not
have
important
it.
To listeners.
It's
the
not
point
important
is,
at
Jeffrey
all.
Dean Morgan is awesome.
He is. He's great in this movie.
Yes, he is.
Oh, man, I love him. He's perfect casting. The second I saw those, like, publicity shots of him in costume, I'm like, oh my god, that's him.
Yeah.
That is the comedian. Awesome. He does a pretty damn good job, too.
And then, speaking of not necessarily doing a pretty good job, I'm going to talk about her for a second. Carla Gugino, who I adore, plays Sally Jupiter,
Suspector One. Yeah.
Carla Gugino, you know, she's been around for a while. The first thing that I know her from, and I think a lot of people know her from, is that she was the daughter, if you will, in Son-in-Law, that Pauly Shore vehicle.
Ooh.
And what I kept thinking in this movie, I mean, she's a great actress, but what I kept thinking while I was watching this is like, I believed her more in Son in Law because
She's clearly a stage actress watching this movie.
Well, I mean, she didn't used to be. She's been in a lot of Broadway productions in the past couple of years, but you know, it's the Matthew Broderick syndrome where she was so good in film because film is so much more of a naturalistic kind of acting style. She does a couple of years of Broadway, comes back, and now she talks like Gloria Swanson or some shit. Like, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. I recently, it was a year or so, maybe a couple of years ago, read these rave reviews of her on the stage for this reproduction? Revival.
Yes.
God, I can't speak tonight. Of Desire Under the Elms.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh man, Carla Gugino is amazing. I'm like, she's in Watchmen!
Yeah.
So I guess it must have been within the last year. But that's all I have to say about that. So, I mean, I guess the point was she is a good actress.
But the problem is we're getting her after Broadway has had her way with
Matthew Broderick syndrome.
Yeah, the Matthew Broderick syndrome.
Matthew Broadway syndrome.
Yeah, where she just, you know, everything she says sounds like, you know, she's about to bust into an Ethel Merman tune. And it just, like, doesn't work. I mean, she's so great, though. I had a massive crush on her when I was a young man.
Oh.
Back when
she is gorgeous.
She was the love interest in the first half of the first season of Spin City. Mm-hmm. Remember Spin City?
I remember that.
And so I was really into her back then. And then, of course, she was the mom in Spy Kids, which is a far better movie than people will give it credit for.
Robert Rodriguez.
The second two, not so much. But, you know, and she was great there. And she's, you know, she's been in a lot of these kind of pictures. Wasn't she in one of the two Grindhouse movies?
I don't know.
Was she in Planet Terror?
If she was, it was Planet Terror. Okay. I didn't see her in Death.
The point is, I've always found her to be delightful. But here, and I remember even watching in the theater, I was like, God, why is she talking in that weird, overdrawn, old Hollywood, get me a scotch kind of way.
Things are tough all over. Cupcake.
Yeah, that random Shatner pause.
Oh, man, if William Shatner in this movie, that would have been awesome.
Now, can I talk about the next guy? Because here's another guy that makes me very excited.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard me mention this guy before, but Matt Frewer, great Canadian actor Matt Frewer, plays Edgar Jacobi or Moloch the Mystic, one of the old supervillains of the Minutemen days.
Of the Minutemen days, yeah. Well, I'm just going to comment before we talk about it as a whole. In the opening credit sequence, when the title of the movie, Watchmen, is supposed to come up, there's a big banner in the background that says Minutemen. So, like, when the word Watchmen comes on screen, you don't know what you're supposed to really be looking at, except that Watchmen's in yellow.
I never thought of that before.
Anyway, go on.
Matt Frewer, though, I love him. He, a lot of people probably know him. I mean, he's a kind of a cult favorite because, of course, he was Max Headroom. On that old TV show and all those old TV spots, and he played both the actual character of Max Headroom and his like human counterpart,
right?
And of course, a lot of people know him as the father of the neighbor kids in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And then the thing that holds him very close to my heart is he plays the principal in a terrible movie that I love with all my heart by the name of National Lampoon's Senior Trip.
That's the one with Jeremy Renner, right?
That's the one with Jeremy Renner, that's right.
Just got nominated for an Best Actor Oscar, so good
really
job, Jeremy Renner.
Fucking good. But I want to watch that movie with you sometime, just so you can see like how the mighty have risen.
Right.
Because, you know, Matt Frewer is doing that shit.
From humble beginnings.
Yes, really, honestly. Jeremy Renner has gone on to be, you know, a great guy. But yeah, Matt Frewer, I love him just so much.
And the next guy is on the list is Stephen McHattie.
Canadian actor.
I believe we know him mostly for Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
I know him mostly for playing Elaine's therapist on Seinfeld.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But he was also on Highlander the series.
Oh, shit.
Which is amazing. He was also in 300 and A History of Violence. Also, Secretary and Shoot 'Em Up. Shoot 'Em Up, which I have seen.
Yes.
And surprisingly enjoyable.
Covered and I still need to see. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's in things. I remember people being really excited during the production of this movie. They're like, oh, Stephen McHattie's in it. But
yeah.
I don't know who that is. But then I found out.
Now, I'll be honest here. I mean, a lot of these are major characters, but there are no other people in this cast that I want to mention, with the exception of, if I may, this guy. And this guy.
Go ahead.
Well, I want to talk about Danny Woodburn, or as Doug Benson refers to him, the Midge from Seinfeld.
That's really how most people know who he is, yeah.
He plays a big figure, as they describe him here, a dwarf crime boss, whom Rorschach and Night Owl put in prison 15 years prior
to
this movie.
He really is just kind of like a dwarf, not even a midget, because in the comic book, he's drawn just like the same proportions as a human being. He's just small.
He's like Danny DeVito.
Yeah, kind of.
Except here he's, you know,
imagine Danny DeVito is a crime boss with a cigar.
Oh, I could totally see that.
It'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I would love it. I would also mention, let's see, Actually, no, I wouldn't really mention any of these other people. Robert Wisden is Richard Nixon, just because Nixon's an important character.
Yeah.
Doing the most stereotypical Nixon impression ever with that
no,
giant nose.
No, I would disagree.
Don't say Franklin Langella.
I'm going to say Frank Langella.
He's so good, though.
I love Frank Langella, but as I've said millions of times before, it feels like he's doing everyone's bad Nixon impression in Frost Nixon.
Fair enough.
I'm telling you, I'm just starting with the president. You know, it's like, it stops being words at a certain point.
Right. But anyway, the other people on the cast list are mainly just like old Minutemen who aren't really that important characters.
But then there's this guy who doesn't actually have a character name, but I have to mention him.
Yes.
Alessandro Giuliani of television's Battlestar Galactica, Gaeta. He plays Rockefeller military base technician. He literally has one line, and it's actually only in the director's cut.
Yeah, and the first time he came on screen, I'm like, Gaeta!
Yeah.
Like the first time I saw it, because I'm a huge BSG fan.
Yes. You need to finish BSG, by the way.
I do.
There's a lot of, there are actually a lot of things that happen in this movie that evoke things that you haven't seen yet that I want to keep telling you about, and I have to hold it in, and it pisses me off.
Yeah.
Watch the show, damn it.
I know. It's my own fault.
Yeah.
I sort of took a hiatus and then never came back from hiatus.
You certainly did.
Between seasons 4.0 and 4.5.
Is that really where you left off?
No. I left off at the end of season 3.
Ah.
But the reason that I didn't watch 4.0 is because 4.5 hadn't come on yet, and I didn't want to forget all of it before 4.5 came back on. And then it just came back on, and I was so far behind that it was like, wah!
Yeah, you need to get through that so
I
you
do.
Can watch the one and only season of Caprica.
Right. Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Also, Doug Chapman is Roy Chess, just because he's the hired assassin who tries to kill Ozymandias halfway through the movie. There's a thing in the book about... there's a chapter, I think it's chapter 5, called... No, it isn't. Chapter 5 or 6, called Fearful Symmetry. And the whole issue is drawn symmetrically. So, like, the first page and the last page are full-page panels. And then it gets constantly smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until the middle of the book when there's a big two-page spread. And I think it's kind of interesting that they mirror that in the movie by having this scene be at the exact halfway point of the movie.
Yeah.
The assassination attempt. Again, there's some overly violent stuff that happens in this scene. That poor secretary gets her fingers shut off.
God.
Really?
They just explode off her hand.
Poor secretary.
Yeah.
Anyway, we finally made it through the cast.
Yeah.
You want to talk about plot a little bit?
Here's the thing, though, if you want to talk about plot. It's kind of hard to tell the plot of this movie without spoiling some of the more emotionally resonant concepts.
Well, I think we should have to. I mean, if you haven't... I'll just do this now, because we always do it. If you haven't seen Watchmen or haven't read Watchmen and are interested in it, don't listen to the episode after this point.
That's right. But also, my name is Jeff Hedley, and I won't judge you if you just watched the movie.
Right. So,
I'm telling you that. I mean, that really bugs me. I hate that. Like, there is this subculture of people who are fans of this movie or the book, or either way you want to slice it, who will say that my opinion is lesser because I've only seen the movie and liked the movie.
Right.
That's bullshit. That's such bullshit. You know, like, my God, I haven't read, like, the actual full-on unabridged version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, but I've seen every single version that's, like, ever been made. Is someone going to come bitch at me about that?
Probably not.
I highly doubt it. I feel it should be the same kind of way. I don't know why I went with that one. I guess because it's the holiday.
A Christmas Carol, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the ghost of Christmas past.
God, I can't wait for that.
I know.
Doctor Who Christmas special. Watch it. It comes out Christmas Day.
Christmas Day in both Britain and America.
Yes, I'm excited. This is not a Doctor Who podcast.
It's not.
Not yet. Anyway, the movie opens with this incredible fight sequence.
Yes.
The comedian Edward Blake is sitting in his apartment watching TV and smoking a cigar because he likes his cigars.
He does.
And his unknown assailant comes in and they start having fisticuffs to Nat King Cole's Unforgettable.
Which is playing on a commercial on TV, but it just kind of rises
and
keeps
going after they put a
bullet
through
the TV. Becomes the overture.
Yeah. I think that's such a great... I mean, it's not original at all to put a sad song or something on top of a scene that doesn't match it.
Yeah.
For a weird emotional effect.
Put a slow dance under a bloody fight.
Basically.
Yeah.
But it works like gangbusters.
Yeah.
I love that scene. It's just so well choreographed. Again, one could probably find fault with the fact that his fist punches through an apartment wall.
And, you know, he slams the comedian's head through a porcelain or marble countertop and with like, not instant death.
Yeah, I've heard Zack Snyder kind of try and justify the violence in this movie. Like, when the comic came out in the 80s, all they needed to see was someone breaking a finger and it was shocking.
Right.
Now we're all so desensitized that I felt I had to ramp it up to have the same effect.
I like that. I can dig on that.
I can understand that. Yeah, certainly. Yeah. So I buy it.
Yeah.
I think as a movie it works. But anyway... So,
I mean, and it also lends so much more of an impact to all the blows. Like, oh, God. I mean, that's a tremendous scene.
It is. I think he even cuts off, all his fingers at one point. But it's a shot that's not very
well. It's very quick.
It's very quick. You're not really sure. I just love how well the opening of the movie, the beginning, 10 or 15 minutes, captures the comic so well.
Yeah, that, because then you lead straight into the opening credits... Which is the entire length of Bob Dylan's "The Times They Are a Changin',"
and then some. And because you'll notice that they repeat verses that he doesn't repeat in the song, and they add a couple choruses of some guy playing harmonica who is not Bob Dylan.
Really?
Yeah, they found some guy to play some extra harmonica solos so that they could fit that song length over the credit sequence. And the credit sequence is brilliant.
Yes.
The credit sequence is establishing to the audience this alternate universe, how events would have played out with superheroes in it. So you've got the plane dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, and on the side of it is painted Silk Spectre 1.
Yeah.
You've got President Kennedy shaking hands with Dr. Manhattan. You've got the comedian being the JFK assassination. He's the guy who shot JFK.
Yeah.
You've got Andy Warhol painting pictures of Night Owl. You've got Ozymandias standing outside of Club 54 with Mick Jagger and Bowie in the background.
Yeah.
Like, that sort of thing. You've got the Kent State Massacre. You know, it's all this great stuff. And it's wonderful. Amazing. It does such a great job of setting the scene for the audience and then letting them know what kind of world they're stepping into. And it's got that great final shot. Nixon elected for third term. And I get anybody who was alive during the Watergate era was like, ugh.
Yeah.
Although, once George W. Bush got into office, I'll bet people started to miss Nixon.
Yeah.
The worst he did was steal from people.
Yeah.
And be a douche.
I'm trying to forget about Bush. I think we as a country have done a very good job, except for Republicans, which decided to change history in their heads and decide that Barack Obama is responsible for every reason that our country is in the shitter right now. You stupid fucking cock nuggets.
Although, this movie... This movie tries to take a jab at Bush at the end.
It does.
Because in the book, the guy, there's this right-wing publication in the book called The New Frontiersman. And at the end, this guy's like, hey, Robert Redford's going to run for president in 1988. And the guy's like, we don't dignify absurdities with press coverage. Who wants a cowboy actor in the White House?
Yeah.
And you're supposed to think, ah, ha, that's funny because Ronald Reagan got elected in our universe.
Right.
So... In the movie, they make it a bit more blatant. Like, Ronald Reagan might run for president in 88. And they're like, we don't dignify absurdities with press coverage. Who wants a cowboy in the White House?
Right.
Like, oh, we have a cowboy in the White House.
Actually, no. We were thankfully free of him at that point.
Oh, yeah, we were.
This came out 2 months after Obama was inaugurated.
Well, it came out in March of 2009, didn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, inauguration, not elected.
Yeah.
I can't think of timelines now.
It's weird.
In 2008, I spent a couple months in England, and I was obsessed with Watchmen during those couple of months.
Yeah.
I was following
You were really getting ready for the movie.
I was following the development of the movie to the letter, and I read Watchmen two or three times while I was over there. So I got myself really familiar with the book before it came out. And awesome.
Yeah.
So the plot, apart from, him getting thrown out a window, is that... Him being thrown out of a window launches this detective investigation by Rorschach, who believes that someone is killing superheroes as a cover-up to something terrible that hasn't happened yet. They suspect it's war between the Americans and the Soviets.
Right.
I think the thing that's difficult to understand for people of our generation, and especially for, this movie coming out now, 20 years after the fact... It's sort of hard to replicate the kind of paranoia that was going on during the Cold War.
It's really true.
And this movie tries so hard to get us to feel that tension, because the first 20 minutes, all they're talking about is how much nuclear war is just around the corner between the United States and the Soviet Union. On the whole, I think they do a pretty good job with that.
Yeah, I mean, and the Doomsday Clock has become this iconic image from this movie.
And it is a real thing.
And from the book, pardon me, yes.
Well, it is a real thing in real life. And it currently stands at something ridiculous like 2 minutes to midnight.
Really?
But, yeah. Can we look that up?
Or I'm not sure matter? I want to.
Oh, it's
can
depressing?
We just move on, Nick?
Don't
please?
Move on. It is absurdly close to midnight, and it frightens me.
It's almost as horrifying as the fucking...
Although I don't think it's ever been, like, less than, like...
Baby Boomer minutes. Death Counter. I told you about that before.
Yes, you did. Yeah. That's horrifying, too. Anyway, he thinks that someone's gunning for masks, and he starts this investigation, and over the course of the movie, it's revealed that people are involved who you didn't think would be. People die who you don't think will die. And there's just this big showdown.
Massive conspiracy.
Massive conspiracy. But, you know, everyone loves a good conspiracy.
Yeah.
Anyway, the villain turns out to be who you don't think it is.
Yeah.
Because they're... Well, I was going to give away who it was.
Don't do it.
Don't do it? Well, I kind of have to. Because I want to talk about the ending. I think it's important.
Do you want to go there now?
When would you prefer to go there?
This is your show. Make the decision.
Might as well. Okay. I mean, we skimmed over the rest of the plot so we could get to the ending, kind of.
Okay.
The ending in the book is significantly different than the ending in the movie. And people were talking for months before the movie came out about how the reports that the ending is different is just a smokescreen. That when the movie comes out, we will be just as surprised as everyone else because they kept the original ending.
Yeah.
What is the original ending?
Alien invasion.
Alien invasion. As it turns out, the villain of the piece has engineered a fake alien attack on New York City, which sounds really ridiculous.
It's like a giant octopus, isn't it?
It's like a giant squid, and he sort of like teleports it in. Like, there's been... The way the book is constructed is there's a lot of little things dropped into every chapter that build up to the ending. Like, at the back of every chapter, there's all this supplemental material, which is just like little short stories or essays or blah, blah, blah about certain small facets of the book that build up this, like, alternate behind-the-scenes world of Watchmen.
Yeah.
And, like, you hear about a guy who was a really good inventor of alien worlds, and a guy who was a really good artist, and, like, a guy who was great with gene splicing. You know, like, and they all vanished. And, like, it's not really... You don't think it's important, because it's just, like, in a little newspaper clipping you read at the back of the chapter.
Right.
Like, you just think it's Alan Moore further developing this world, but at the end you're like, nope, they were all kidnapped so they could create this alien. And, like, the alien gets plopped down into the middle of New York City and kills, like, 15,000 people. And the idea is everybody in the world will see this threat from completely outside their frame of reference and unite to combat against it. And it works in the book. The Soviets and the United States are like, holy fucking shit, there's an alien there that just killed 15,000 people.
Right.
Let's put aside our differences so that we don't get destroyed by giant squid monsters. It doesn't play out that way in the movie.
And I don't think it could play out that way in the movie.
I think if you'd put that on the screen, it might have looked kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because even as it is, the first time you read the book and you haven't picked up on all the clues, you're like, what? Why did they just do this? Like, really, Alan Moore? Really? But anyway, in the movie, the way that they do it is the main guy's scheme is he's been replicating Dr. Manhattan's power under the guise of he's going to solve the energy crisis and thus hypothetically end the war. What he's really going to do is blow up 15 cities around the world with the power, frame Dr. Manhattan, and get everyone to unite against Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah.
I almost feel that for the movie, this works a little better.
Oh, yeah.
Because it makes the story arc more personal. Because you've been familiar with Dr. Manhattan the whole movie, it makes his connection to all the characters that much more, like, important. And it sort of makes everything that happens... It's on a grand scale, and yet it feels more intimate and relatable, rather than an alien invasion.
You know, this is one of those points of contention that I've had problems with the people who will, you know, disregard my opinion because I've only seen the movie. You know, I heard... someone told me that the original ending was the giant octopus, and I said, you know, regardless of whether the book can explain it well enough, I know moviegoers, and I know myself, and I know that we wouldn't have cottoned to that. And I also feel that from just an emotional standpoint, as you just said, having Dr. Manhattan be the patsy works a million times better than I could ever imagine. I'm not saying I know for certain, but that I could ever imagine a giant octopus alien hoax could have been.
Right.
You know.
And the way they would have had to explain all the little backstory to make it work, which the movie just didn't have time to do.
It couldn't have done it.
It had so much on its plate just adapting the main story.
And they completely avoid Tales of the Black Freighter, although I know a lot of people who read the book who are like, good riddance.
Good riddance. Yeah, I hate reading the Black Freighter bits of the book. I always want to skip through it, but I have like this obsessive compulsive complex where it's like, read everything.
Yeah.
They actually did animate Tales of the Black Freighter into like a 20-minute movie starring Gerard Butler, yeah, and Watchmen, the ultimate cut,
which I never want to see.
Oh, me neither. Incorporates Tales of the Black Freighter, yeah, into it, because the way that they use it in the book as a device to mirror what's going on around it and make little commentary. Although for a movie, why would you want to watch like pirate commentary about what's going on? It's kind of lame.
That's the thing about, you know, going from about these two mediums, you know, comic books and film. Film doesn't require that kind of subtext.
No.
And people who think that it requires that kind of subtext are just confusing people.
Right.
You know, so... Yeah.
But again, it would be like, especially in the movie, every time it's long enough. I don't want it to be 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Like, every time...
How long is the director's cut?
About 3 hours.
Jesus.
It would be even longer. It would be close to 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Every time, like, something's happening, oh, we're going back into the comic.
Yeah.
With pirates and sharks and shit. Like, really? But anyway, so that's the change of ending.
Yeah.
I felt like it worked fine in the movie.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm totally on
board. But you know what's actually kind of interesting is that Alan Moore, he didn't realize this at the time, but there's actually an episode of an old TV show called The Outer Limits where the same thing happens. Scientists, engineer...
The Architects of Fear.
The Architects of Fear. Yeah. They engineer a fake alien to make people be like, holy shit, we've got big problems, so let's stop fighting.
Yeah.
And he didn't realize that he'd basically stolen a concept. So at the end of, like, issue 12 of Watchmen, they're watching The Architects of Fear on TV, and they sort of insert that into the movie, too, as, yeah, sort of a little homage, which I thought was kind of nice.
Interesting bit of trivia, you know, we've talked about on the show, and people know the story, it's a big thing in nerd culture. One of the projects that Kevin Smith was almost hired to write a screenplay for back when he was writing the screenplay for the once almost film Superman Lives, was a feature-length adaptation of The Architects of Fear.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But I gotta wonder, you know, if that had ended up being what he did, and they actually went through with it and made the whole movie, how would people have handled Watchmen, you know, however many years later when they made it, you know?
I do not know. I mean, I'm not sure how many people knew The Architects of Fear when reading the book.
Right.
Again, I'm not sure that the alien is that important in the big thing. I mean, it's just sort of like, oh, the villain wins this time.
Yeah.
And the villain isn't just a comic book villain out for world domination. He wants world peace.
It's a real gray area. It's a real kind of BSG way to do business. Because it's like,
yeah,
you
basically.
Know, yeah, because
at the end of the movie, they're basically forced into silence. Because if they expose him, they undo the world peace that he has created.
By doing a terrible thing.
By, yeah, basically committing
genocide.
What amounts to genocide. Yeah. Yeah. Killing 15 million people. I mean, and the one thing I might have a problem with is Matthew Good's performance is how calm he is throughout the whole thing. Out of all the casting in this movie, his is really, like, apart from Alan Ackerman, who, as we said, is serviceable, so we,
yeah,
won't talk about that too much more. His is the only casting that I have any problem with, because in the book, he's much more charismatic and much more emotional. Like, there's this iconic panel after he succeeds that shows him with both fists in the air yelling, "I did it!" Which would look stupid in
that
a movie.
Feels like something out of Naruto.
Naruto. Yeah, it's weird, because, like... because when Laurie, Silk Spectre, shoots him with the gun and he catches the bullet and everything...
Yeah.
It's kind of ironic, because that's the only scene in the book that is drawn in slow motion.
Oh.
Whereas the movie uses tons of it all the time. But he goes, "Hi-ya!" and catches it in slow-mo.
That sounds...
It's really cheesy. I don't know why they do it and just why they go cheesy in the final chapter, but, like, he has this sense of elation, of accomplishment.
It sounds very anime, what you're describing.
Yeah, very anime. Well, yeah.
Did he twirl around and then do a peace sign and then a big smile?
I wish he had. the humanoid typhoon, indeed.
Yeah.
Ozymandias.
God.
The stampede. No. No, God, no.
Johnny Young Bosch!
Yeah, I should have been in this movie.
You son of a bitch.
No, he shouldn't have. He shouldn't have been in this movie.
He should be in more things, though.
He should be. But anyway, I think that changing, like, that aspect of his character is kind of odd. It makes his character kind of underwhelming at a very critical moment. Because after he succeeds, he acts exactly the same as he did before.
I think there's something to be said. There's something to be said for how chilling a calm villain can be. I mean, yeah, in the grand scheme of things, there is that gray area about whether or not what he did was for the common good.
And that makes it especially...
But at face value, what he's done is a terrible thing.
Right, and that makes it even more gray in the book when he's overjoyed at having succeeded.
But I think it works with him being calm, because as he's calm, it's unnerving because you're like, God, he can do this and still keep a straight face? Jesus.
Right. And he has that, like, throwaway line, I made myself feel every death. Made myself look at every innocent face.
I will say that when you put that in perspective with the calmness, it is a bit much. But when you just think about that as just a face value concept, I see exactly what they were going for.
Yeah, and clearly him playing him like that was a conscious choice.
Yeah.
Matthew Good is a great actor. He was in another movie that I really like called Match Point, the Woody Allen movie.
God, I don't care for Match Point. I could not get through Match Point.
Well, he was in it, and he was good in it.
And as I was mentioning while we were watching the movie, that he's like the top name on the list of people to potentially play Superman in the next time they try
and
to do
it. And I am going to disagree.
I am too.
Because Matthew Good is just so lanky. Like, he doesn't have the physique for Superman, for one thing, but also I think he's too old to play Superman. I mean, how old is Clark Kent supposed to be? In his 30s? I mean, like, they always draw him like he's 45,
When Clark Kent first comes to Metropolis, I think he's supposed to be, like, 29.
Okay, because, like, when they... Especially in, like, the animated TV shows, they always draw him like he's a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
Like, mild-mannered Clark Kent, who's a 50-year-old reporter at the Daily Sun, or whatever it's called.
But you also have to keep in mind that he's Superman, and he doesn't really age past being an adult, which doesn't make any sense, but whatever.
Whatever, yeah.
Because, you know, of course, as I mentioned, the other name that a lot of people kept bandying about made me smile, of course, is Jon Hamm. Play Superman, and
I would believe Jon Hamm over Matthew Good.
Oh yeah, but you know who's actually I've heard in addition to Matthew Good, and this one I think is actually it's the best of both worlds. You know, you get your Matthew Good and your Jon Hamm, you put them together, you get TV's Joe Manganiello.
Oh, from True Blood.
Alcide.
Yeah, yeah. Alcide. Mm. Oh, there's a hunk of a man.
I'm just saying. Could you imagine?
Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
They would have to make him less scruffy.
I mean, in a perfect world, I would say, just keep Brandon Routh and stop being bitches about it. But
people were bitches about Brandon Routh?
A lot of people were, unfortunately.
But he was in Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah. Why are we talking about Superman? This is fucking Watchmen.
Because it's a superhero movie, and it's related to another superhero movie, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, now that we've talked about all of that,
yeah.
What do you love about this movie? Like, do you have anything that really stands out for you as being awesome?
Well, here's the
character, a scene, or idea?
I was going to say, you know me as a movie viewer, I'm not the guy... I don't like... Cinematography doesn't catch my eye. The aesthetics. It's interesting that I just, you know, graduated from the University of Choice on a film and television production degree with a curriculum that is so much based on, like, a love of aesthetics and knowing why, ooh, they turn the camera that way. Don't you see how artistic that is? I was never that guy. I never got it. I was taught all this shit and didn't understand it and didn't care to know.
Right.
So, but as just a flat-out movie fan, like, there... What I react to, what I get off on, if you want to use that terminology, when it comes to film and what really, you know, brings out the cinema lover in me, is when something, and I don't care about the technique, but if you can make me feel, if you can, like, put something in my emotions that wasn't there before, outside of a laugh in a comedy or, you know, a swoon from, you know, Emma Stone, it's a matter of, you know, if you can, like, the opening montage... The times they are changing, like, you're just, my eyes are glued to the screen. I'm just, like, in this quiet reverence. I cannot let go. There's so many great, like, music montages in this movie, or so many great uses of music. And that's, and as a bit of a story about jazz, I've got to stop and point out one thing. God, my, like, little rants on any of our shows are so weird and have, like, multiple parts to them, and I congratulate anyone who's able to get through them alive. But anyway, no, when I was in high school, I was big in the theater, sort of the precursor to my work in the film, you know. And one of my favorite things and what ended up being, like, my calling, in a way, in the theater department at the my particular high school in my hometown was music coordination. In my senior year... and also in my junior year, I was sort of put on staff as the music coordinator for a number of plays. We did a show called Making It, which is this terrible, you know, like on-school, after-school special. We did a show called David and Lisa, which is about two people in a mental institution who fall in love.
Murat Saad. No.
What?
You know that play, Murat Saad?
No.
Oh. It's basically the story of Marat, who I don't know who that is. I don't remember who that is because I actually saw this play as told by the Marquis de Sade.
Okay.
And it's
so it's like Quills?
Kinda. It's like the Marquis de Sade is in a mental institution a la Quills, and right. And has the inmates act out this play he wrote about this French-like national hero named Marat. It's a very weird play.
Right. But anyway, music, coordination. I got a lot of, toot my own horn, but I got a lot of rave reviews for what I did with that. We did, in that production of Dave and Lisa, I scored the entire show with Coldplay, and on a lot of, there were certain songs I did have picked out for certain scenes, but for the most part, I was up there in the booth improvising and deciding, and just based on how I was feeling and how the play was making me feel in that exact moment, what song needed to play. It was such a rush, and I miss it. And
that's sort of what there is now a credit that usually comes up in the opening credits of movies, music supervisor, who basically does exactly that. They provide tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of songs for films that they sort of help pick and choose what goes in what.
Don't think I haven't thought about that as a career, but I'm just saying, what my point is, music really does something for me emotionally. You know, and I love a good use of a song. There are a few things in cinema, on the whole, that do me better than a really good use of a song. And this movie's chock full of them. I mean, like I said, you know, the opening sequence, the funeral scene for the comedian with the Sound of Silence. Gorgeous.
You know, and that's weird though, because I've heard people complain about the use of the Sound of Silence there.
I'm totally in for it.
I think it works.
I feel like for how much, The Sound of Silence, you know, it's most famously, you know, kind of originated, if you will, with The Graduate, which is just what it was. But it was coming out, right around, it was pre-Vietnam, but it still had a very, holy shit, Vietnam is on its way kind of feel.
Right.
And, you know, and Simon and Garfunkel really became, for a lot of people, this kind of, soundtrack to that era.
Right.
And when you consider the fact that the comedian story, so much of it is about how much, the things he did in Vietnam. We see a very particular scene about his time in Vietnam. And the fact that they would use that song for his funeral. Beautiful. It's, right. That's where it works for me.
You think it works because you are smart enough to make those connections. I think a lot of people had problems with the fact that because these songs have been used so iconically in other movies, I think they felt it detracted from the movie here.
So they're watching The Funeral and thinking of The Graduate.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Or the use of The Ride of the Valkyries in another Vietnam sequence.
Yeah.
Because they'd used it so iconically in Apocalypse Now.
But it works because that scene is horrifying.
And I think they're trying to evoke a movie like Apocalypse Now by using that.
I wouldn't even say that. I'm so glad I get to talk about this. You know, talking about music. You know, there's something about the way Ride of the Valkyries feels. It's so booming and so it feels like war. I mean, they use it in commercials for Risk, for God's sakes. Remember Risk? Of course, I've been over it. All the old Risk board game commercials, they use Ride of the Valkyries in every single one of them. And there's a reason, because Risk evokes the horrors of war. And to see in that scene, you have the comedian just gunning people down. You have Dr. Manhattan, who has let himself grow to a giant size and is just killing people with the point of his finger. I mean, it's a horrifying scene, and then it's followed by the scene in the bar where we find out that while he's been in Vietnam, Edward Blake has fathered a child with a Vietnamese woman who is pregnant, and then he shoots her dead. Jesus Christ! I'm just saying, this works. There's a mood being set, and it stays there, and just makes you stew in it. God, I love it.
That's also something that Zack Snyder was quick to point out during the making of the movies. You guys are complaining so much about the squid not being there. I, as a fan, would be upset if they cut out the scene where he shoots the pregnant woman.
Yes.
Because it's so important to his character. And, I mean, holy shit, the scene where he almost rapes Sally.
Ugh.
That is a brutal scene.
Yes.
And it is not very comfortable
to watch.
Pulls
no punches.
It pulls even
less
punches
than the
book.
So many uncomfortable shifting in seats when I saw it in the theater on opening
night. Yeah, I mean, the book, not nearly as graphic
or brutal. You can't make us feel as uncomfortable in a book with that situation as you can in film.
Yeah, I mean, I love that the movie doesn't avoid all those dark areas that the book had, which is what made it such a weirdly compelling read. So yeah, I agree with you about moods being set and whatnot.
I mean, I've never really gotten to express this. It's never really been something I've really gotten to go into, but just, God, I love a well-placed song. I love timing. I'm a sucker for car chase, now let's play Jet. Which has become a big staple. We watched, I Love You, Beth Cooper, which I believe will be coming out, or my episode will be coming out the same day as this. they're, when they're out driving through the woods and fucking Try It Again by The Hive starts playing, it feels corny, but it feels fucking right. This fast-ass song, which of course was very famously most recently used in the trailers for Getting to the Greek. You know, this song, as they're speeding through the woods, headlights out, she's going crazy, thing with the shirt and the raccoon. We watched the movie. We talked about it on my show. But you get what I'm saying. Like, I love a well-placed song, and this movie's full of them. Like, if I could point out one particular aesthetic thing in this movie that just gets my goat, that's it right there. The music works perfectly.
And I think the camera work in general is very nice.
Yeah.
It's got a very... I love the look of this movie.
It captures the comic book imagery, or so I've been told, but I mean, there's some...
Well,
I mean,
like, I'll take, for example, the opening sequence. After the opening credits, you see the comedian's blood-soaked badge lying on the pavement, and then the camera just goes up the side of this apartment building to get to the detective's standing on his balcony. And in the book, you know, you just look at the panels getting progressively higher, but he's just copied the panels of the book for this really nice swooping shot up the side of the building.
I've read that far in the book.
Yeah.
So I can tell you for certain that I know that's true.
Right. You know. There's that great shot where they're talking in his apartment complex, and the camera just starts pulling back from the window until eventually there's this giant panorama of the city with the blimp hanging there.
Yeah.
And they say, "I think this thing is bigger than the both of us." Now, that shot does, like, two things. One, it's a comment on what they're saying, because now it's so big that you see the whole city, and you're like, oh, it's big in scope. But also, it draws you into the world. They're blimps! In New York, you know, it's like that kind of weird...
Zeppelins
in New York, like these weird little touches, you know. And the blimp's just an ad for a diner.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of world it is. I mean, little elephant blimp.
Yeah.
It's just an ad. I love it.
Yeah.
And it's got a very nice, glossy sort of look to it. It looks kind of like a comic book brought to life.
Which, I know, I appreciate, because you'll remember when we were talking about V for Vendetta, and we talked about Watchmen kind of offhand in that situation, about the fact that the Watchmen comic book... You know, you said it was colorized from the beginning, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, it too is that weird rave color situation, the way V for Vendetta, when it was colorized, was. And that was one of the things about the comic book that kind of turned me off, what little I read. Even that was enough to tell me that, like, I mean, the whole thing was done that way. This is the dark, gray realism of life with people being tossed out of windows and giant blue men.
Giant blue men. Want to talk about Dr. Manhattan?
I know what you're about to talk about, so yeah, we'll talk about it.
Let's talk about
how stupid some people are.
Yeah, let's do it. people can't seem to get over the fact that Dr. Manhattan is naked the whole movie.
Not the whole movie, but for the better part of it.
I would say about 99% of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
In the comic book, he has more clothes at different parts of the movie. At one point, when he first starts out in the 50s, he has a suit that goes over his chest, his torso, and he's got, like, those little pants things that he wears.
Right.
And he might even have a hat at the very beginning also, like a skull cap.
Yeah.
And he progressively loses the clothes and then just becomes totally naked.
This
is in the comic. This is to symbolize his growing detachment from humanity.
Right.
Why would he wear clothes when he doesn't feel connected with the rest of the human race? Why would he feel the need... to, you know, cover his shame, have some decency. He doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, and no one in the universe of this movie is questioning it.
Yeah, but the thing is, they make such a big deal about him being so removed from humanity. You know, you don't give a damn about human beings.
Yeah.
You know, like, that whole thing. Why didn't no one in the audience get that? Why were people making such a big deal about it? It's so obvious.
Because people are stupid and they were like, ah, he's got a dick! Can you see the rage in my face just then? It was boiling inside. I was like, I felt the urge to punch something. I was like, you stupid fucks. You're staring at his cock when everything else around that cock is amazing.
Yeah.
That should be the least of your concerns. Stupid movie-going audience, you stupid fucks. It made me so angry. The only good thing to come out of the fact that everyone would shut the fuck up about Dr. Manhattan's penis is a quote that I've gone on to use on a number of occasions. Doug Benson, our good friend Mr. Doug Benson.
Who we met.
I would consider him a good friend. Mr. Doug Benson, when this movie came out, he referred to it as one long-ass blue dick movie. And while I winced a bit because I was like, even you? really, Doug?
You love movies.
You love movies, and you should be able to, you know, see the forest for the dick. And, you know, like, but he doesn't see the forest for the dick. But ever since then, every now and again, I'll have a long day, and I'll tweet something. I'll say, God, it's been one long-ass blue dick day.
And the thing is, in the comic books, the way that Dr. Manhattan is drawn, David Gibbons draws the genitals in a very unassuming way. It's just a couple of lines down there to let you see that it is there, but he doesn't make a big deal about it. But
the thing is, the movie, though.
But the thing is, if in a movie you can't draw them like that,
no.
You have to, like, make it look like a real dick.
Yeah.
So once they added in, you know, the swinging dick, because, you know, that's realistic, I think it was a lot harder to ignore than it is in the comics.
But even then, if that's all you're paying attention to,
you're missing everything else.
I want to punch you in the face. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Dr. Manhattan is a great character.
Yes.
Oh, man. It's amazing to watch him sort of drift away from humanity and then sort of regain it at the end. It's like, it's great. I love it. But anyway, there's that. Speaking of dumbasses, I want to talk about the sex scene.
Let's please talk about the sex scene.
The sex scene. It's sort of like a two-parter.
Okay.
Because there's an attempted sex scene earlier in the movie. Because Laurie
I love a sex scene.
Oh, my roommate James has entered. You've seen Watchmen, right?
My cousin, who knew nothing about the film, happened to walk in one day. He came to visit while I was watching Watchmen, and that's what he saw on the television. So that's all he saw? He didn't know it was a feature film that I was watching.
Oh, so he just thought it was like a superhero porn. That's great. But earlier in the movie, Laurie is trying to have sex with Dan, and he can't keep it up because he's just, like, nervous and blah, blah, blah. And then they get back into the costume, and then they go out and save some people in a tenement fire, and all of a sudden he's all riled up, and they have sex in the airship. And they play Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah on top of it, and people got so, like, up in arms about this scene. For no reason.
Yeah, I told you one person I knew made a big to-do about the fact that when he ejaculates, he hits the flamethrower button on the ship and the flames go out for a second. Which this person who was like, this person refused to see the movie based on hearsay because this person had read the book and was like, they didn't know do the book right, claim that doesn't happen in the book.
Which it does.
It happens in the book. Thank you.
So yeah, that corny visual pun happens in the book. So.
That person is wrong and they need to.
But I feel like that scene is important because, yeah, you can make an argument, I guess, about it going on too long, but they sort of need it because it's a very important scene in the character arc of these two characters fulfilling their relationship, and all of a sudden, he feels like a man again after all these years of hiding in plain sight, he now all of a sudden feels like a real human being.
In addition, it's supposed to be kind of funny.
Kind of. Yeah.
I think it steals a little too much from the opening speech from I Love You, Beth Cooper. I think, like, I don't know.
Wait,
little,
what?
What?
You can think about that.
Okay.
Thank you, James.
James, ladies and gentlemen. What the hell just happened?
An enigma that we must ponder.
What the hell is
I'm
that?
I'm going to ignore that. I think it's because we just watched I Love You, Beth Cooper, and he was there for
certainly.
But you were actually you made a connection with Shrek while we were watching it.
Yes, because the problem is, I'm right there with them. The problem is, in the past decade or so, most people's first experience with that song is the version that plays in the first Shrek. And it's not Leonard Cohen
Rufus Wainwright.
Rufus Wainwright. Everyone's so used to that, when that scene played, even in the midnight showing I saw with all those mostly, you know, nerds who were ready for what this movie had to offer, there were a lot of laughs.
I think, though, that was kind of the point.
I do too, but I'm saying, in addition to that, I've actually heard people say that the reason why they couldn't take it seriously was because of Shrek. And I'm like, really?
Well, I mean, Shrek is such an important movie not artistically, but culturally, certainly.
Right.
So, to use a song like that is kind of a risk. But using Leonard Cohen's version,
which is as awkward as the actual scene.
Right.
It works.
Yeah, it works. And I mean, I read a review that said that scene alone, one shot in that scene probably birthed an entire new generation of leather fetishists.
Yeah.
Because she's got these, like, really sexy high-heeled leather boots on during the whole scene. But really, I had no problem with the scene. I loved it.
I got exactly what they were going for. The song is meant to make you feel awkward because the sex is awkward. It's passionate. They're going at it like fucking, it's just hot pig sex. But It's meant to be fucking awkward. If you feel awkward, you're supposed to enjoy it.
And since when has sex in real life never not been kind of awkward?
People want to believe that fantasy that sex is as, you know, well choreographed and passionate as it is on television.
Well, it isn't.
It's not. Trust me.
It's not. So in that way, again, we got a little bit of realism here.
Yeah.
But again, like I said, just in terms of character arc, it's important that that scene be there. And then that scene have some significance and impact. So, again, you people are dumb if you went on and on about... People just went on and on about unimportant things.
Yeah, I'm saying, like, these are the things that have gotten the most attention in this movie. When they, like I said, they are missing... They can't see the forest for the dick. Mark it. Make it a quote. I'm just saying it's a problem. Because there's an amazing... thought-provoking, beautifully shot, well-scored movie going on around all this shit that they're just completely ignoring and deciding to find fault with the entire picture because of.
Well, the score.
We'll say the score.
Let's talk about the score for a second.
Tyler Bates.
Is by a guy named Tyler Bates, who basically only gets work because he knows Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
He's done all of Zack Snyder's movies, and the score he wrote for 300 was pretty epic, but following that... He basically got sued by the people who represent Elliot Goldenthal because he basically just ripped off Elliot Goldenthal's score for Titus.
I was going to say that there's a lot about the score to Watchmen that reminds me of some of the more, like, technical-sounding parts of the score to Batman Forever.
Well, that's also by Elliot Goldenthal.
How about it?
So I think that Tyler Bates has been overly influenced by Goldenthal.
Yeah.
Because everything that he writes... I mean, what I really like about this score... I was commenting on this before we start watching the movie because they had a piece of music playing during like the DVD menu.
Yeah.
And you were like, oh man, that sounds so bad in 80s. And I'm like, well, when that the first time that score was published, it was published on the Watchmen website and they had pieces of it playing on like the pages for the different characters. And the way that they paired it on the website really worked. Like there was this tinkly guitar music that plays for Silk Spectre. And it's like, oh, it's nice guitar music with this heartfelt soundbite they're playing on the website.
Right.
That's really nice. Oh, there's this desolate-sounding guitar music that they have playing when Dr. Manhattan's talking, and he's so far removed from humanity. That's really nice. And they've got, like, this really weird synthesizer Blade Runner music that they're using for the comedian. That's really nice.
Yeah.
And they don't use it in any of that way in the movie.
They switched around for a lot of people.
They switched around a lot of it, and... The uses of it doesn't really make much sense to me.
No.
Like, there's a scene where... The first scene where Rorschach and Night Owl are talking. And he's like, oh, those were good times. Weren't they, Rorschach? What happened? You quit! And then it shows him just standing on the stairs for a couple of minutes while this weird music plays in the background. Like, why are they playing that music there?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to quite fit. I think it's great that Tyler Bates tried to recreate the sort of Blade Runner feel.
Yeah.
For an 80s... It's not sci-fi, but it sort of, in a way, evokes Blade Runner.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that he tried to do that, but it makes me sad that it doesn't have any distinct themes or continuity.
And there were a few moments, like, where I was like, God, this sounds like fucking Top Gun. Like, it didn't... I was like, this should not be happening. Like, I see this, and I'm thinking, Danger Zone! Like, it shouldn't be happening that way. In addition, like, not just that, but, like, you know that scene in the first Ninja Turtles... Where it's after they've gone to the farmhouse and April O'Neil's sitting there and Casey Jones comes up behind her and starts giving her that background and there's that tinkly kind of like, ooh, rustic sex kind of music playing in the background. It's like that. And I'm like, God, this does not belong here. You want to talk about the soundtrack since we are talking about music kind of more thoroughly?
Let's
again?
Do it.
I mean, there's a lot of great musical choices. How do you feel about 99 Luft Balloons?
I was actually just about to ask how you felt about 99 Luft Balloons, because that's the only one that I might have some contention with.
I don't. You know why?
Why?
It's as awkward as Hallelujah.
But is it supposed to be an awkward scene?
I think
She's
it is.
Just going to a restaurant.
It's... Okay. You gotta put yourself in the mind of... What's his fucking name? Daniel Dreiberg. You gotta put yourself in his mind with his weird Chevy Chase and vacation-looking ass. You've gotta put yourself in his mind, and in his mind... As she appears in the doorway of the restaurant, 99 Luft Balloons plays in his head. It's that inner iPod, you know? It's like, he's got that song in his head. It scores.
Is he cool enough to listen to 99 Luft Balloons?
Who said 99 Luft Balloons was cool? I love that song.
Boom.
I love that song, though. But seriously, but you know what I'm saying? Like, that was my... That's how I took it.
Right.
So...
Well, I think it was intended for a comedic purpose.
Exactly.
It starts to get really cool with the cool drum beat. When it shows him at his most gawky.
Exactly! It's brilliant, well-used songs! God, it's good.
The only other song I would really point out... Well, there's All Along the Watchtower at the end.
Yeah, I gotta shut my mouth for a minute.
Why, you didn't like that?
No, I do, but I can't tell you why.
Why?
it's something you need to see in something that isn't this.
Is it the use of All Along the Watchtower in Battlestar Galactica?
Yes.
I've seen that.
Oh, you did?
That's in season 3.
Oh, awesome. Then you know exactly what I'm talking about. Yes. Yeah. Okay, never mind. Yes, that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, I like it just because it lends a sense of epic to it. Because if you listen to Bob Dylan's original version, it's just him with his guitar and his harmonica, and he's singing the song All Along the Watchtower, and it's very spare. And then Jimi Hendrix did it and made it this giant epic rock song. And even Bob Dylan plays it the Jimi Hendrix way every time after that.
And I do love, you know, the scene they use it in is when they're driving the airship
into Antarctica.
Archimedes into Antarctica. And there's that one point where, like, they're starting to lose fuel and they kind of crash, like, skid into the top of the glacier. Uh-huh. And right as they're doing that and they're kind of spinning is that part in the song where the guitar goes, like, I love that. It works. Like,
oh, yeah. See, I love that shot because the camera goes entirely upside down to follow the ship.
Yeah.
So that the ship stays in frame the whole time. So when the camera pans back, Antarctica, the surface of Antarctica is at the top of the screen and the sky is at the bottom. I really love camera work like that. There's a movie from the 40s, I want to say, called Ballad of a Soldier. It's a Russian movie. And at the very beginning, there's this bit where the main character is running away from a tank. And they do it, like, in an aerial shot where they track the tank so that eventually, basically, everything is upside down because they've just been following the tank. And everyone in the theater was laughing because I guess they thought it was corny. But I'm like, that's awesome. But I also noticed the way that the camera goes, the guitar does that when the camera flips over.
Yeah.
You know, I love that sort of, that thing when,
well-placed music, son!
When image and music match so well. The second season of The Wire, the HBO show, there's a shot where, the dude throws a rock into a security camera, and it splinters the screen, and then the camera just drops. So, like, it doesn't, like, fall off the post, it just sort of drops down so that now you're just looking at the ground. And, the theme song for The Wire is this Tom Waits song called Way Down in the Hole. And they use the Waits version in season 2, and there's a bit where the guitar goes, like something like that, and they timed it exactly so that it matches the camera falling.
Awesome.
And I always thought that was so cool. It's basically exactly what they did.
Yeah.
The other big song is a cover of a Bob Dylan song that they did, especially for this movie, Desolation Row, which is like a 12-minute song on a Bob Dylan album called Highway 61 Revisited. And the band that they got to cover it is a punk emo band called... Shitty band called My Chemical Romance.
This is the only song of theirs I love. The only song of theirs I've ever heard, actually, but it's... Am I really going to have to listen? I've gotten so self-conscious. We talked about it. But, you know, I love this song. I love this song.
I don't mind the song. I think that it's kind of... The way that they use it, I don't know. It feels too... modern, I don't know how to describe it. Like, the way that the movie ends with, like, the screen goes black right as modern rock starts playing. It feels very kind of, like, after all this whole serious movie, like, all of a sudden, we're going with, like, action movie credits here.
I dig it, because you know what it says to me? Aw, fuck, maybe things won't turn out all right.
Maybe. And true, the tone would have been totally different if they'd used Bob Dylan's original version.
Yeah, right?
But maybe... I don't know. I like Bob Dylan.
I'm just
so.
Like, because I'm like, as it's zooming in on the journal and that organ part of it is playing, and then as soon as it's like, oh shit, what's going to happen? Like, oh my god, yes! Like, you always just ejaculate right there. It's just so...
And then they play more Leonard Cohen.
I never got that far through the credits.
Very rarely do I get that far. They play First We Take Manhattan, which is an interesting choice. It's very 80s. Very synthesized.
I'm sad they don't play Jazz Police.
Jazz Police, they're police who play jazz. Nobody likes Jazz Police, and I don't know why.
Except for us.
Well, we like it because we kind of make fun of it.
Yes.
Anyway, Jazz Police.
Oh, shit.
Is there anything you don't like about this movie?
Carla Gugino's performance.
No, we already talked about
that. Like I said, I can't stress it enough. I love her. I think she's wonderful, but she has got too much Broadway in her for this movie.
I think in general, the performances in this movie are awesome.
Yeah.
Jackie Earle Haley is amazing. Patrick Wilson is always dependable. Matthew Good is fine. Jeffrey Dean Morgan is awesome.
Oh, God, yes.
God, he's so great.
Yeah.
I love the comedian. He's just such a great character.
Yeah.
The comedian is Laurie's dad story arc.
Is that in the comics?
Yes, that is in the comics.
Okay.
There's that bit where she's on Mars with Dr. Manhattan, and she finally figures out that the comedians are dead, and she gets really angry and, like, shatters the glass palace. And... In the movie, they leave out one crucial scene that explains why she's so angry at him. Like, the comic, she's like, oh yeah, she's bitter, but like, there's a scene where she's at a party and she confronts him and she's like, what, do you get your kicks, you know, raping women? And like, he looks at her with all this remorse in his face and he says, like, only once. Like, and she gets like, she misinterprets what he's saying because he's actually filled with remorse and right. She doesn't realize that he's her father. So she misconstrues it as like the ultimate misogynist comment and like storms away and like throws her drink in his face and like blah, blah, blah.
So with that
out of the movie, it's sort of harder to understand why she's so angry at him.
No, I can understand it. I feel like if they were to have included that scene, I feel the exact opposite that you do. I feel like if they would have included that, that would have made her anger make even less sense. Because the way they present the comedian as a presence in her life in this movie is as this wisecracking, you know, old veteran guy that she finds to be kind of charming in his rough and tumble ways. And he's, you know, he's kind of not flirting, but kind of, you know, joking around with her. And then her mother comes over and takes her away. It's the whole thing about, you know, I mean, she's got daddy issues. They say that everywhere. But, you know, you want what you can't have.
Right.
You know, and there's...
So you think of it less as anger and more like...
All the time I could have spent.
Right. And also sort of like a personal sort of disgust, like, oh my god, I almost hit on my own father. Less than anger.
Kinda. But I think it's actually more all the time I could have spent with my father.
Right. Okay. You think of it more as like a tragedy, what could have been angle, rather than, oh my god, this guy I hate is my father.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. I buy that.
See, that's... Sometimes I do get philosophical.
Sometimes. Is that philosophy?
I don't know. What the hell's philosophy?
Boom.
I'm so stupid.
I think the philosophy is like that whole thing, the speech Dr. Manhattan gives about...
Right. About I'm just using philosophy as a sort of a... just a grand word to describe intellectual concepts.
Right.
That's what I'm doing right now.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've been talking about Watchmen for an hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah, we have.
So I feel like it's probably about time we should...
You feel like you said all you need to say? Have you covered all the topics you wanted to?
Yeah, or we should settle on a few final topics, if you have any.
I can't think of any right now.
All right, then we will go into favorite moments.
Okay.
Yeah, favorite moments.
Favorite moments. A lot of it is definitely Rorschach-based.
We haven't talked about him at all.
That's true.
Want to talk about Rorschach just a tad bit?
Let's do it.
Okay. He is Batman, basically. He's the Batman figure.
Yes.
I mean, I read somewhere that all these characters are kind of, like, represented by other older comic heroes, but I haven't really heard of any of them, except for, like, Batman. Rorschach is such an iconic character. He's got that awesome mask that is, like... It's got, like, the way... They don't tell you how he gets it in the movie, but in the book, he works as, like, a dressmaker, which is really odd, because he's such a misogynist, like, right-wing, homophobic character.
Yeah.
And, he's working on this dress that's, like, two latex, like, sheaths, and in the middle there's black ink. So when you move around, the ink moves. But the way that the movie uses it, he makes it for his face mask, and it sort of mirrors what his facial expressions are supposed to be. It's like his expressions, his emotions are expressed on the mask at any given time.
Would you suggest that the movie suggests that it's some sort of magic?
Magic? No. Again, they don't explain it in the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, so many of them, I thought it was interesting watching the movie, because you're supposed to think while watching it, holy shit, this guy's crazy, and yet everyone comes away thinking just how much of a badass Rorschach is.
That isn't exactly how I put it. It's Rorschach really taps into this very... You know me, I hate Republicans, I hate where I grew up, so there's so much amount of me that is not Rorschach, but few things are as satisfying in movies than watching him hack a dude in the head with a meat cleaver who just raped and killed a little girl.
Right. Well, you like that sense of justice. In the book...
I'm a big fan of justice, sir.
In the book, he handcuffs him to the thing like he does, and then he sets his house on fire and leaves. He doesn't actually kill him.
That's nowhere near as satisfying as just the plunk of every head of the fucking blade.
I feel like they've done that in a movie... Well, like, he basically gives him, like, a hacksaw and says, you can either cut your hand off or burn down in your own house. And the guy burns down in his own house.
Yeah.
Which is very Saw.
Yeah.
You can cut through your own thing or die, basically.
Yeah.
I think they might have changed that so that the audience wouldn't think, oh, they did that in Saw.
Yeah.
But they ended up with
something much more impactful. Yeah, just like something that really, like, you know, like you, like, you, it, there's this rush of like, yeah, with every fucking just strike of the blade. You know, I hate pedophiles, sir, with a fiery passion. But then again, what decent person doesn't? But, like, there's a... I'm not like a capital punishment guy, but I'm going to make a statement here since we're talking about this. I think pedophiles should get the death penalty. I absolutely 100% do.
I personally feel we don't have the right to kill people. Even if, like, legally, I feel like that's wrong.
Political debate!
Political debate. I'm totally against the death penalty, but that's a topic.
But I'm just saying, this is a weird peek into the mind of Jeff, you know?
Weird peek in the mind of Jeff?
Please don't judge me.
I'm sure you're not the only one who thinks that pedophiles deserve to be put to death.
I do. I truly do.
You are not the only one, I guarantee it. But anyway, but yeah, everyone always comes off thinking, you know, how great it is. Like, when he's in the prison, he's like, you don't seem to understand.
Oh, God, yes.
I'm not locked up in here with you. You're locked in here with me.
That's my favorite everyone line in the theater, in the whole fucking movie.
Everyone in the theater, whenever I went to go see it, was like, yeah!
That happened in the midnight showing, yeah.
Yeah, everyone comes off thinking that he's just a badass. And you're kind of not supposed to.
No, no, no. I feel guilty for finding him to be a badass because he does some gruesome stuff. But the thing is, as I said, I've got this sense of justice. And there are very few people that he does terrible things to in this movie that I don't feel deserve it.
Right.
I mean, say what you will about the whole thing with the guy and the prison bars and the, you know, belt sander thing or whatever, but, you know, and then the guy, you know, tries to beat him up at the lunch line, he puts the grease in his face. Like, that's just prisoner shit. But, right. You know, out in the real world, hacking up a pedophile's head, I'm in. Let's do it.
Fair enough. There's I'm that scene person. Where... I just wanted to mention that there's that scene with the psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Who basically gets a whole chapter to himself in the book.
I feel like I've gone that far, actually.
While he's in the book, it takes him several sessions to get to the story about Rorschach and the little girl. He's so underplayed in the movie. Yeah. I just wanted to comment on that. I don't really have anything to say about him.
I mean, he has that interesting image during, like, the climactic
event. The thing is, in the book, all these little characters that they've spent time with, you know, the kid reading Tales of the Black Freighter, they all die at the end, which is supposed to give this massive... horrific event, some emotional impact, rather than it just killing a bunch of anonymous people you've never seen.
In the comic book, does the kid reading the comic hug the guy who sells him the comic?
They might, I think so.
Because he does it in the movie, and that always gets me.
Yeah, I think they do it in the comic, too.
Like, as they're about to die, he, like, grabs onto him, and they, like, kind of float up.
It
tears me in half. I love it.
Well, it's supposed to. You're supposed to get the impact of it by watching all the minor characters die, basically. So, yeah, that's why they bring the psychiatrist back at the end. It's sort of weird. In the book, he's kind of a dumbass. Because, like, remember he's holding up the Rorschach cards and he's like, what do you see? And he's like, flowers. You know? In the book, the psychiatrist...
A pretty butterfly.
Yeah, in the book, the psychiatrist believes him when he says that.
Oh. But in this movie, he don't take no mess.
No, he doesn't. You just see that, like, face. Like, right, nice flowers. Yeah, right, you moron. Like, I don't believe you.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's that.
Yeah.
Rorschach. I felt it would be bad if we didn't talk about Rorschach.
And honestly, like, this is no disrespect to the other characters, but I mean, honestly, we've taken the time out to talk briefly individually about Rorschach and Dr. Manhattan and the comedian. Honestly, those are the ones that really kind of deserve that kind of attention, I feel.
Yeah, the other ones, they're interesting, but I don't...
They're kind of the straight man of the piece.
Kind of, if it were a comedy. Because Rorschach's a real funny guy. It's so great because, like, there's so many, like, Rorschach jokes in this movie that you can only get if you've seen the movie or read the book.
Yeah.
Like, well, he tried that, what was that guy in Captain Carnage who just went down the street yelling, punish me, punish me? It was like, no. He's like, whatever happened to that guy? Well, he tried it on Rorschach, and Rorschach threw him down an elevator shaft.
Awkward silence. And then laughter.
Like, everyone in the audience that I was watching with, like, two people laughed at that.
I laughed.
I'm like, okay, those are the people who get it.
Yeah.
Cool people. Everybody else is like, what?
Yeah.
What a horrible man threw a guy down an elevator shaft. Anyway.
Rorschach just taps into, like, the, if I were a violent man, I don't know. Maybe that's probably the worst thing to say on public broadcast, but it's...
You should know that Jeff Heatherly is an alias that this person has been using entirely throughout the run of our show and his show.
Please don't do that to me.
I won't, no.
I'm not a very violent man, but, you know, in my mind's eye, I got this thirst for justice, and Rorschach doles out some pretty fucking awesome justice.
Indeed. One other thing that I would like to mention is Hollis Mason's death scene.
Which is only in the director's cut,
and I think it's a really nice scene because the Not-Tops are going in and they're killing him basically. And while he's fighting them, he's having these flashbacks of his glory days. Like while the sad music starts playing, and it's really rather touching.
Yeah, kind of cool, but just I don't like it.
Why not? It's important for Dan's character arc and for how he behaves in the bar.
But I'm saying I was able to enjoy the theatrical cut without seeing that. And it didn't. And seeing it in the director's cut didn't add anything to it. And considering how clunky the setup to that scene is, it makes it seem like, why is this even happening?
Right.
I'm not a fan of that. I'm not. That's okay. Why I prefer the theatrical version. I'm telling you, you say that you think this flows better. I'm telling you, I've watched the director's cut with you twice now, and I stand by the fact that I think the theatrical cut flows perfectly.
Well, like I said, both times you mentioned that, I think that they don't really so much add scenes as take scenes that are already there and just extend them a little
bit. Except for that right there.
Yeah.
Which might actually be the whole crux of the problem.
Right. I mean, they only add, like, they add a bunch of stuff with Nixon in the war room, and they add that big sequence. They don't really add that much else, except for taking the scenes that are already there and extending them so that they feel a bit more naturalistic and you sort of learn a bit more through the dialogue and whatnot.
Okay.
But yeah.
We'll agree to disagree.
My favorite moments, I love the opening credits.
Yes.
I love the opening fight sequence. I love the whole Dr. Manhattan origin sequence is amazing.
It is.
I love that.
That's another one of those moments of well-placed music.
Yeah, they use Philip Glass's music from Koi Anasazi in there a lot.
Yeah.
And it works really well. They used it in the trailers, I believe, and everyone was like, oh man, it works so great.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just used it in the movie. That whole sequence plays with how Dr. Manhattan perceives time, and it works so well. It's a great sequence.
Yeah.
And it follows the book, like, to the letter. It's awesome. So it's a great adaptation and a great film at the same time.
Now, that's one of the things where the director's cut differs a bit. Because in the theatrical cut, that sequence happens as soon as he's at that news conference and says, "Leave me alone!" As soon as that happens, boom, he's on Mars in the theatrical cut. In this version, we have, like, 5 minutes of something else that I really didn't need, and then we go there. And it just seems kind of awkward. There's a lot more. I know we see, we're watching it on Hollis Mason's TV, and we see what it happening in a replay.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly feel like because it's a replay, we don't get the instantaneous just...
Book, he doesn't teleport out of there to Mars. He teleports all the reporters out of the
which
room.
Which they do in the director's cut right there.
Yeah.
And that's the change. Because
and
in the actual cut,
Mars.
It makes
yeah.
you think he teleported himself.
Right.
Didn't do anything with anybody else.
Right. And I think that the movie is kind of interesting in that they don't tell you where he sent the reporters.
See, that's another reason why I don't like that.
In the book, he just sort of sends them to a parking lot. But like in the movie, it's got vaguely sinister...
Exactly. Well, there you go. But as a movie fan of the movie, I don't like that. I think that's a character development that kind of makes him seem a little too sinister, even if he does just send him to a parking lot, which, even you said, the movie doesn't even tell you that. That, I don't like that, what that suggests about him. Because we're coming off of a scene in which he's found out that, at least as he's been being told that, like...
He's given cancer to, like,
all
the
important people in his
life. Three of the most important
people in his life, and, you know, that's gonna fuck with a guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I dig the theatrical cut. I really do.
That's fair. I don't mind.
You know, because I mean, we should tell the listeners that, you know, part of the reason why this has been delayed so much is that we had a lot of problems. Like, we're going to do this on location. We're going to do this here. We're going to do a long distance version, and I only had a theatrical cut. You had the director's cut. We were going to do sort of a comparative study.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, I guess I'm familiar enough with the theatrical cut that I'm able to give you your comparison
right
here and now. So yeah,
that's that.
Dig the theatrical cut.
I really have very few like. Quibbles with this movie.
I don't either. Like I said, I think it's damn near perfect. It's of the three Alan Moore movies we've watched, it's the one that I have that I can just really just settle in.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I love watching it. I've watched it several times since it's been out on DVD. It's so long that you can't like just watch it whenever.
Exactly.
But when I do watch it, I always really enjoy it, and I always find something interesting to latch on to and watch it. So I think that's great. Final thoughts on Watchmen?
Damn near perfect.
Straight enough.
I love the theatrical cut. And once again, if you're one of those jackasses who wants to say that my opinion is not valid solely because I've only seen the movie, once again, I have nothing to say about the book. I won't say it's good or bad. I love the movie. Suck it.
Boom. And I will say that I love the book and the movie. And for what the movie could have been, I am damn grateful that this is the one we got.
Yes.
So, anyway... Watchmen from 2009, directed by Zack Snyder.
You gotta stop doing that.
Okay, Zack Snyder, not Rob Schneider. Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
The final entry in our month and a half of more.
Yeah. Something like that.
Our series of episodes based on the work of beloved comic book author Alan Moore.
The asshole savant.
It wouldn't be a Month of Moore episode if you didn't say that.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, mostly bad. I am Nick Melton.
I'm Jeff Heatherly.
Good night, everybody. But here, in our little village of Antarctica, you might say that everyone,
each one of us,
tooth polish for smokers! Double.